to talk about an element of the Christmas story that many people miss. And I shared some of this a few years ago, but I want to revisit it because the application of this has everything to do with how we as Christians respond to a need like the one we just heard about. I think one of the challenges for us when it comes to the Christmas story and the birth of Jesus is there is what we think happened. There's like the picture in our minds, right? And then there's what actually happened as told to us by the gospel writers themselves, the real story. And those two pictures are not always the same thing. See, what happens is over the years, we get influenced by the traditional or popularized retellings of the story. We get influenced by the nativities that we see and movies, Christmas songs, all that stuff that just reinforces some of these misunderstandings. Now, with some of the details about Christmas that we may have wrong, maybe there were 7 wise men and not 3, right? We're actually not given a number. But big deal, that doesn't change the meaning. But if there are ways that our faulty assumptions about the story, that those assumptions change or diminish the meaning of Christmas, well then, we kind of want to know about that, right? So we tell the story of Mary and Joseph journeying to Bethlehem because of the census that the gospel writer Luke mentions. And Mary is very pregnant, about to give birth, basically. And in our minds, they arrive in Bethlehem with no time to spare. And they can't find a place to stay. And the inns are full, and door after door is slammed in their face, no room. And then finally, some kind soul at the very last minute lets them use a smelly animal stable out back. And so we assume Jesus is born in a manger or stable alone, except for the animals that are sharing the stable with them, and then later some shepherds and some magi show up. That's basically the story of the first Christmas from Scripture, right? The problem is almost none of that happened like we remember it and tell it and according to what we read in the Gospels. So this is going to be fun. I am drawing from the scholarship of Dr. Kenneth Bailey and his book, Seeing Jesus Through Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. And it's an excellent book. More importantly, Dr. Bailey, who passed away not long ago, he spent his life as a New Testament scholar living and working in the Middle East. And so he taught seminary. He studied Middle Eastern culture. The guy was fluent in New Testament Greek, Hebrew, Arabic, probably some other things, maybe English, who knows. And in his lifetime of study and experience, it really helped him to see the Gospels in Jesus differently. Not so much through a Western lens or set of values, but it helped him see it through a more Semitic lens and perspective. And he discovers that so many things in the Gospels that are confusing or strange to us as Westerners make perfect sense from someone coming from a Near Eastern or Middle Eastern worldview or background. So I kind of want to walk us through really the more problematic issues that Dr. Bailey raises with our traditional telling of the Christmas story. Are y'all up for it? Okay. Remember that you said that, first of all. Remember that the Christmas story begins with Joseph and Mary returning to the village of Joseph's origin as the census required. Luke says this, "So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David." Now, in the Middle East, family ancestry, your roots, connection to your family of origin was very, very important. Back then, you could trace your family lineage several generations and often much further. This means that your relationship with your extended family, your bloodline is extremely important. Family loyalty is like everything. By the way, this is true in many Middle Eastern cultures today. You could trace your roots way, way back. If you're not convinced of the importance of this, Look how Matthew begins his gospel. No modern Western author would dare to begin a book like this because, again, as Westerners, we don't value long genealogies and our roots the same way. You have the internet, and I bet you couldn't come up with your lineage that's half as long as this. And so for them, when Joseph shows up in Bethlehem and says, and he's mentioned here, I am Joseph, the son of Jacob, the son of Matthan, the son of Eleazar, and on, it's about him. His lineage, that family tree meant something. When he arrives in the village where, by the way, his people come from, most likely many of them continue to live, his relatives, in a non-mobile society. So many people in Bethlehem, even if they don't know Joseph personally, they would have known or heard of his relatives, his extended family, if not been actually related somehow to Joseph. You add to this the fact that Joseph is from the family line of King David, returning to Bethlehem, also known regionally as the town of David. So Dr. Bailey contends that Joseph, from the famous family, this guy would be welcome anywhere in town, of course. And this is in a culture where hospitality is among the top of the social values. That said, we completely miss this. We tell the story like they arrived in Bethlehem, no connections, like they were left completely on their own to fend for themselves. That simply was not the case. On top of that, in virtually every culture on earth, except maybe ours, a woman about to give birth is given special attention. In other words, simple rural communities, rural villages, all over the world, always assist one of their own women in childbirth, regardless of the circumstances. So what does this mean for the way that we tell the Christmas story? Were the people of Bethlehem just exceptionally heartless in this moment? I mean, they'd have to all be busy celebrating Christmas to be as unhelpful and non-compassionate as they are, as they're portrayed. Do you get the joke? Because they didn't know? Okay. My point is, no Jewish village back then would fail to help a young Jewish mother about to give birth. The village would have sensed its responsibility to help Joseph find adequate shelter for Mary and provide the care she needed. And again, there's the added incentive that we hardly need here to turn away a descendant of David in the town of David would be like an unspeakable shame on the whole village. Check this out. We know from the gospel writer Luke that Mary had relatives in a nearby village, that a few months before the birth of Jesus, Mary had already gone to stay with her cousin Elizabeth in the hill country of Judea. And apparently she was quite welcome there by Zachariah and Elizabeth. Well, Judea is a small territory. Think like East Central Indiana. Bethlehem is in the center of it. So arriving in Bethlehem, they could not have been too far from where Zachariah and Elizabeth lived, which, of course, they would be welcome there, as they have already demonstrated. Which means if Mary and Joseph couldn't find shelter and hospitality in Bethlehem, very unlikely, they could have at least turned to Zachariah and Elizabeth as a last resort. Son-in-laws in the room, how are your in-laws going to react if they find out later the predicament that you are in with their pregnant daughter? That you were too proud or whatever to go to your wife's extended family to ask for help. That you insisted, I'm going to do this myself, right? In a stable, alone, with no help or assistance. But, you point out, of course they didn't want this to happen in a stable alone. That wasn't their preference. Joseph was probably freaking out, but it was a matter of necessity, right? That they arrived in Bethlehem in the dead of night and Mary's ready to have the baby at any minute. Like maybe they didn't have time to go those few extra miles to Mary's relatives. So most Christians imagine that Jesus was born the same night Joseph and Mary arrived in Bethlehem. Hence, Joseph's panic and their willingness to accept any form of shelter, even a stable. And of course, our traditional Christmas pageants reinforce this every year. That said, all we're doing, folks, is looking at the Bible. According to Luke, it seems that Joseph did, in fact, have time to make decent arrangements. Luke 2:4 says, Joseph and Mary went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea to Bethlehem. And then two verses later, Luke records, listen to this tone. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born. That phrase, while they were there, the time came, has a bit of a different tone than the second they got there, Mary's water broke or whatever, right? So Luke doesn't say how long they were in Bethlehem before the birth, but almost certainly it was long enough to find decent shelter or, again, to go a few miles away to Mary's family. See, as a husband, I can admit to you that I have procrastinated things before. Maybe even important things, but this is not the kind of thing that you put off. Suddenly, our Joseph is not looking all that thoughtful or prepared. So to summarize the problems with kind of the popular or traditional way we tell the story, the problem is it discounts several things. First of all, the way we tell the story overlooks the value of hospitality in first century Bethlehem, let alone their obligation to care for a woman about to deliver a baby. The way we tell the story overlooks the significance of Joseph's family lineage. He's from the line of David. He has connections. He has relatives in Bethlehem, the city of David, that would have almost guaranteed they'd be welcomed in and taken care of. Apparently, they did not arrive in the dead of night with Mary about to deliver the baby. According to Luke, they arrive with at least some time to prepare. Worst case scenario, yes, the census was taking place. Lots of people are coming home. Maybe it was really crowded. But still, they could have gone 5-10 miles away or wherever to Mary's nearby relatives. A very small journey compared to the one they made from Nazareth in Galilee. So some of these assumptions that we've inherited about Jesus' birth, not only are they not accurate, it's worse than that. They actually, and we'll see this in a minute, they take away from the actual meaning of the events of the first Christmas. It's interesting, our popularized notions of what happened, really that comes not from the Gospels, but from another source dated somewhere around the second or the third century. It is called, and it's a mouthful, the Protoevangelium of James. And James, neither of them had anything to do with it. The author was not Jewish. It's clear from reading it. Did not understand Palestinian geography nor Jewish customs. Back then, it was common for people to write books claiming to be a famous person. Anyway, the work is full of imaginative details, and the church mothers, the church fathers at the time, were very quick to reject this as an inauthentic work. In the novel, Mary has her baby right as they're reaching the outskirts of Bethlehem, and it goes on and on. But for various reasons, the average Christian today, who's never heard of this, is still unconsciously influenced by it. So for us, to begin to get a better picture of what really happened, or at the very least, what the writers of the Gospels are actually telling us happened, we have to talk about two important details the text itself gives us. So two questions: where was the manger, and what was the inn that some translations talk about? And the crazy thing about this is, if you actually read just the Gospels, what they're saying, all of this confusion that we've brought up immediately gets cleared up. Luke chapter 2, verse 6. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born. And she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. Now, we hear the word manger, and we're just conditioned to think like a stable or a barn. And that's totally not it at all. You're picturing Little House on the Prairie, actually. Dr. Bailey points out that homes in first century Palestine had only one or two rooms at most. If a house happened, here's one room. If a house happened to have two rooms, that second room was used primarily as a guest room, which is kind of weird for us. I mean, I have to have like at least nine rooms for me before I'm ready to dedicate another room just for guests. But again, that's how highly they valued hospitality in the first century. So this guest room would be basically attached to the primary house like an add-on, or it could be built on the roof of the single room dwelling. We see this in the story of Elijah in 1 Kings 17. Elijah says, "Give me your son." He took him from her, the mom's arms, carried him to the upper room. That's the guest room. This one's on the second floor, where he was staying because he was a guest, and laid him on his bed. So it could be on the roof or attached. This main room here is the family room, and it's where the entire family cooked, ate, slept, and lived. And you can see on this diagram that on this left end of the room, this part of the house is a few feet lower, and there's a door there. And sometimes it would be the same level, but it would be blocked off with like heavy wooden beams. At night, they would corral the family cow or donkey or a few sheep into this lower area. And then every morning, they're taken out and tied up in the courtyard of the house. And then the animal stall is cleaned for the day. Bailey writes, "Such simple homes can be traced from the time of David up to the middle of the 20th century. I have seen them both in Upper Galilee and in Bethlehem." I love that. "Dr. Bailey, how do you know this is how it was?" He's like, "Because I've seen it. Because it's been like this up into even modern times." So the roof is flat. The guest room can be built on it. Or, again, from the top of the same house, it could be attached over here to the end of the house. This door here on the lower level, this is for people and the animals. The farmer, by the way, wants to have his animals in at night, both for warmth and to make sure they don't get stolen, right? Bloop, bloop. Yeah. These circles here, as you can all read, these are mangers. And they're dug out of the lower end of the living room floor. And this is kind of cool. A lot of times these floors would slope down toward the stable part, so you could just sweep the house, sweep it into the lower level, and then out the door. And by the way, if a cow gets hungry in the middle of the night, it just stands up and eats from the manger right there in the living room floor. So this architecture is standard. In Hebrew scriptures, King Saul was a guest in this woman, she was a medium, it was a weird story, in her house. And it says in 1 Kings 28, "Now the woman had a fattened calf in the house." This woman takes it, and that was in the house, kills it, and then prepares a meal. So clearly, she doesn't get the cow from out in a field or out in a barn, but right inside the house. There's lots of examples like this. This architectural insight also makes sense of something Jesus later says. When he says in Matthew 5, "Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house." Obviously, Jesus is assuming a typical one-room village house, if a single light is going to give light to everyone. I love this scene in Luke 13. It's the Sabbath, and Jesus heals a woman who Luke says was bent over and could not straighten up. In Luke 13:12, it says, "When Jesus saw her, he called her forward and said to her, 'Woman, you are set free from your infirmity.'" And the word freed here, he's literally saying, "You are untied from your infirmity." Well, the head of the synagogue gets angry because Jesus, in healing her, has worked on the Sabbath. And so Jesus responds, "You hypocrites, doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie your ox or donkey from the stall and lead it out to give it water?" What's his point? His point is, you untied an animal. I untied like a woman. And Luke says that they were put to shame. Jesus knows that every one of these guys has an ox or a cow or something in their house they tie up at night, and that every one of them had gotten up that morning on the Sabbath, untied it, let it out into the courtyard. According to Dr. Bailey, one of the earliest and most carefully translated Arabic versions of the New Testament, which was written around the 9th century, translates this verse like this: "Does not every one of you untie his ox or his donkey from the manger in the house and take it outside and water it?" This Arabic translator is like, doesn't everybody have a manger in their house? Because for him or her, that's how it always is. All right, so we've got the manger and with it, baby Jesus in the house. Whew. What about this inn detail that we're given? Because again, that sounds like they were kind of rejected. They didn't have any other place to stay. And it was only after all the hotels were full, they finally managed to get this spot. That phrase, there was no room in the inn, that guarantees 100% that we're going to misunderstand what's happening. To us, that sounds like there is an inn that before Mary and Joseph arrived, all the rooms were already occupied. It's interesting that Greek word here that's used for room, it's not the word for like a room in an inn. It's the Greek word topos, which just means space. So there's no space for them. Like you'd say, there's no more space to put anything on this table or whatever. But the most important word in that sentence is the word that gets translated in. Luke uses the Greek word, stay with me, kataluma. Please note, this is not the ordinary Greek word for an inn. They actually had a word for that. In fact, in the parable of the Good Samaritan, also told by Luke, chapter 10, the Samaritan takes the wounded man to an inn. And the Greek word in that text, also written by Luke, is the word pandokeion. The first part, pando, means all. Keion means to receive, as in to receive all, as in. That's what they called a commercial inn. All that to say, if Luke wants his readers to think that Joseph was turned away from an inn, what word might he have used? The word that he uses later, that he himself knows. But in Luke chapter 2, verse 7, it says it's the kataluma. There is no space for them in the kataluma. What does that word mean? Literally, a kataluma is simply a guest room. You know what's so cool about this? Luke removes any need for us to speculate about ancient word meanings. Again, if Luke is the one using this word and he doesn't use the word pandokeion or commercial inn, if he instead uses this word, well, we should pay attention to any other time he brings this word up. In other words, let's let Luke translate this word for himself. And we're in luck, because in Luke 22, he tells his disciples, Jesus does, he says, "As you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters and say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher asks, where is the guest room?'" And there is the same word, kataluma, "where I may eat the Passover with my disciples. He will show you a large room upstairs, all furnished. Make preparations there." Ding, ding, ding. Does this man have a commercial inn on top of his one-room house? No, the upper room is just a guest room, and a nice one, built on this guy's roof. It's a guest room, kataluma, in a private home. So most translations translate this as inn, even though that's actually not the word that Luke uses. Now, the NIV, in this case, actually gets it right, and it translates it as guest room. There was no space for them in the guest room. By the way, there is no innkeeper mentioned at all in the story, and do you know why? Because there's no inn involved at all. Besides, an inn would have been totally unnecessary for all of the reasons we've already discussed. It makes a lot of sense to me that if at the end of Luke's gospel, the word kataluma means a guest room attached to a private dwelling, that he probably means it in the same way near the beginning of his gospel. And so the family room with an attached guest room would have looked something like this. Luke is telling us in plain Greek, Jesus was placed in the manger, in the family room, in this home, because why? There was no more space in the Cataluma, in the guest room. Alfred Plummer, who was an influential New Testament scholar from over 100 years ago, so this is how far behind we are, he wrote this. It is little doubtful whether the familiar translation in the inn is correct. It's not right. It is probable that Joseph had relied upon the hospitality of some friend in Bethlehem, whose guest chamber, however, was already full when he and Mary arrived. Here is what Luke is trying to tell us. Mary and Joseph, who of course had connections in Bethlehem, in a time and place where hospitality was like a given, especially for a pregnant woman, especially for a woman who was about to give birth. Luke tells us that Joseph and Mary were received into a private home. Here's the question. Why weren't they invited into the guest room? We don't know. It's likely because there's no space, because there's a census, and who knows, maybe five families are already living in there when they arrived. But here's the point that our Christmas pageants and our nativities miss. Rather than coldly sending Joseph and Mary out back to have their baby in a barn, a stable, alone, which again they didn't even have back then, they do something far more compassionate, far more humane than we've given them credit for. The attached guest room is full. There's no space in the Cataluma. So, the host family graciously welcomes Mary and Joseph into the family room of their house, meaning into their precious and limited space. Of course, the room would have been cleared of the men for the birth of the child. The village midwife, other village women would have been there to assist at the birth. But the point is, Jesus wasn't born isolated and alone outside in some shed. He was born at the center of someone's, yes, humble, but someone's home. Almost certainly surrounded by a community of support, caring for Mary, assisting with the birth, caring for the baby. After the child was born, Luke says, Mary put her newborn to bed, fresh straw in the manger, right there, and covered him up with a blanket. Now, please hear me. I am not saying that we should throw away our nativity sets, or that, remember this, or that we should interrupt the children's program, you know, nativity thing, and just say, excuse me, that's not really what happened, okay? From experience, nobody wants to hear it. Choose your battles wisely, and maybe we could just agree to keep this our little secret. It's probably going to be best for everyone. Besides, I'm actually not even convinced that I can get most of you here today to trade your kind of the popular understanding of the story for what I think Luke is very clearly saying. And look, I have slides, okay? Something about imagining Mary and Joseph showing up late at night, panicked, can't find a room at the inn. They give birth to Jesus, isolated, alone, back in the stable with some shepherds. We just like that version for some reason. And again, most of us will probably forget all of this and default back to that nostalgic version of the story. And it's fine. It's fine. I mean, the main thing is we get Jesus here. We all do that. And that's the important thing, and we agree on that. But, just for us here today, in the interest of telling the full story, know this. The Jewish people of Bethlehem did their best. They offered all they had to offer, even if it wasn't much. They responded with compassion and selfless generosity, and that was enough. So I just think it's high time to say to the people of Bethlehem, well done. Like, I know you've gotten a bad rap for a few thousand years, but thank you for doing what you did. well done to this family who, having already packed out their guest room, cleared out of the family room space in their home to give the village women and Mary some space. Well done, men who passed buckets of water through this door while they waited outside and tried to help Joseph calm his nerves and waiting for the midwife to come out and to give them the good news. Thank you, people of Bethlehem, for being there for Mary, Joseph, Jesus, when none of us could be there. Just ordinary to us, anonymous people who did not and could not have known to whom they were showing kindness that day. I hope I would have acted the same had I been there. Mary and Joseph had to have been so grateful and relieved to have their needs met like this. Maybe they even thought to themselves, someday if someone, even a stranger, is in a situation like this, I hope we can show them the same kindness the people in Bethlehem showed us. Or maybe they didn't think that because of course they would do that. Because that's what God-fearing people do for those in need. Of course, Jesus himself, years later, brings this whole topic up. He says, "For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." No wonder Jesus valued compassion and kindness. He knew himself what it was like to have no home. He said about himself, "The Son of Man has no place to lay his head." He knew what it was like to rely on the kindness and the hospitality and the generosity of strangers as he traveled from village to village. I am guessing that he remembered the stories he heard about his birth and being invited in and treated with kindness. He remembered how when he was a kid and his parents had to flee as refugees to Egypt. They had to go to a strange place, far from home, different religion, different customs, completely different language. And the story of his life was receiving compassion and kindness from strangers. How brilliant then for Jesus to say, not just, "Therefore go and be compassionate." Do you realize he doesn't stop there? Instead, he holds up compassion and kindness and generosity as high as he possibly can by saying, "When you do this for others, you're actually doing it for me, personally." "Well, Lord, I had no idea. We didn't know this." And he's like, "That's now you do, because I'm telling you." What higher motivation could he give for these kinds of actions? And he says, in caring for that stranger, "No, you didn't literally feed me or clothe me or provide shelter for me. You didn't literally make room in your family room for me to be born in Bethlehem because, of course, you weren't there. But whenever you're helping meet the needs of someone else, just know, you do it for me. It counts the same. It's the same as if you were doing it for me personally, and I'll receive it as such." By the way, this passage goes on, and there's a pretty sobering warning in the verses that follow, because he flips it and says, "Likewise, if you don't do this for someone in need, then it will be counted as if you failed to care for Christ personally." So all of that brings us to the need we heard about this morning, and I'm not going to try to add to what Ari shared. But we have the opportunity to bless others who don't have a home yet. We have a chance to bring some hope to some families who desperately need it. According to Jesus, not me, according to Jesus, what we do for these refugees, we do for him. Now, I didn't tell you the best news yet. The good news is this. We are not asking you to make room in your guest room for an Afghan family, or if you don't have one, to clear out space in your living room. That's actually not what this refugee resettlement organization wants. They're, of course, trying to provide actual homes, actual space, which is what you would want if you were in that situation, to provide some dignity, with the goal being long-term stability. So, the good news is we're not asking for your house. The good news is we're just asking for your money. Whew, right? Or maybe your time. Whew, okay. Listen, you may have little to offer in terms of financial resources. You may have more, but that's not the point. Maybe you can get involved with your time. There are other ways to show kindness and hospitality. The point, the invitation, is to respond as Christ would have us. It's an amazing thing that Jesus sets up. We get to bless others. Think about this. We get to bless others, and at the same time, Jesus says, let the record show that you did that for me as well. To put it in our terms, you guys have heard of, he's saying this, you've heard of a matching gift, right? This is like the ultimate matching gift, right? So what better time at Christmas? You heard Ari present, by the way, Ari is Jewish, speaking to a Christian congregation about how to help predominantly Muslims. Last time I checked, those three groups don't always get along that great. In an increasingly polarized world over all kinds of ridiculous things, this is what we should be doing. Unquestionable good in our community. It's what Jesus would have us. And as we remember the story of Jesus' birth, what better time to respond with kindness and compassion and generosity towards strangers in need. When we tell as part of the story Jesus, who fled with his family as a refugee running for their lives, what better time to bless others in a similar situation? I want to invite Cliff to come on up. We're going to have our offering for this now. As Ari said, there are different ways to give. If you weren't prepared or you don't have a checkbook, I don't always have that with me, you can go online, and I encourage you to do this even right now if you're ready and willing to do that. If you're making a checkout and you're going to drop it in the basket that goes by, please make it out to awakeninc-marrc. And of course, if you want to go home and do that, you're welcome to do that and send it in that way. But it'd be very helpful if all the checks were made out straight to the organization. Any cash that goes in the buckets now or the baskets, we're just going to give it to them as they leave. So, would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we thank you for this really powerful reminder of compassion and kindness and generosity. And Lord, it doesn't stop there. You then look to each one of us and remind us that what we do for the least, what we do for the hungry, those who don't have homes, it's the same, it counts the same as if we did it for you. May we follow your example in our generosity, in our kindness with our money, with our time, with our relationships, with our caring. It's in Jesus' name we pray.